Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It was midnight when the quake struck. The kids and I screamed. One of our rooms was destroyed. Our neighbors screamed, and we saw everyone's rooms.
A massive earthquake hits Afghanistan. It's killed more than 1,000 people, with the death toll expected to rise, as humanitarian appeals for the country now ruled by the Taliban have not yet seen major responses. And half of Afghanistan already faces acute hunger. We'll get an update. We'll also look at the looming global food shortage amidst the war in Ukraine, one of the top wheat suppliers to Africa. We'll go to Somalia, where as many as 13 million people are already facing severe hunger amidst an ongoing drought.
1.5 million children below the age of five are already malnourished. And we expect that 366,000 of them may not survive through the end of September.
Then we'll look at the World Trade Organization's decision on COVID vaccines.
After 18 months of negotiation, last week we learned that rich countries and the pharmaceutical industry are going to get their way at the World Trade Organization. There was a window of opportunity for them to temporarily share their intellectual property so that the world could have access to medicines, and they refused.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Aid workers and Afghan authorities are struggling to reach areas devastated by an earthquake Wednesday that killed more than 1,000 people, injured more than 1,600 near the city of Khost. It was the deadliest quake in Afghanistan in 20 years. There are reports entire villages have been destroyed. Survivors are using their bare hands to rescue people trapped under the rubble. Communication lines are down in parts of the area, and torrential rain has washed away roads, making many areas impossible to reach. Recent flooding has killed at least 400 Afghans. The Taliban has called for more international aid, while saying sanctions have hampered the government's ability to respond to the multiple crises facing the country. On Wednesday, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs pledged to help Afghanistan.
It's in a country that's already on the brink. We know that. It's food security situation is where we're talking about. We're close to a famine-like situation. So people are really already hanging on by a thread. So when this disaster comes on top, the de facto authorities in Afghanistan did reach out and asked the UN for help. Of course, we stand ready to help anybody in Afghanistan.
The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is holding its fifth public hearing today. Democracy Now! Will live stream it beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern at democracynow.org. The committee will focus on Donald Trump's efforts to pressure the Department of Justice to overturn the 2020 election. Witnesses will include former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, who took the post following the resignation of William Barr. The committee's pushed its next hearing back to July in order order to give committee members more time to review a flood of new evidence into Trump's coup attempt, including previously unknown video of President Trump and his family and associates recorded by a documentary filmmaker before and after January 6th. The filmmaker, Alex Holder, recently complied with a subpoena from the committee for his footage. He'll be privately deposed by the committee today. The New York Times reports Holder's video includes an interview from December 10, 2020, with Ivanka Trump, in which she defends her father's challenging of the election results, saying he has to take on this fight. Look, you fight for what you love the most, and he loves this country. Her comment appears to contradict her testimony to the January 6 committee that she accepted William Barr's assessment from earlier in December 2020 that there was no widespread election fraud. In related news, the Justice Department has subpoenaed the chair of the Georgia Republican Party for information related to Trump's plot to submit fake electors to the Electoral College. Subpoenas have also been issued to other individuals involved in fake elector plots in Arizona, Michigan, and Georgia. Meanwhile, the seditious conspiracy trial of Enrique Tarrio and other members of the far-right Proud Boys has been pushed back to at least December due to the ongoing House January 6 hearings. In news from Uvalde, Texas, the head of the school district's police force, Pete Arredondo, has been placed on administrative leave as criticism mounts over the police response to last month's school massacre when an 18-year-old gunman shot dead 19 fourth graders and their two teachers. On Tuesday, Texas Department of Public Safety Director Steve McGraw described the local police handling of the shooting as an abject failure. McGraw said there was a sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to confront the gunman 3 minutes after the gunman entered the school. However, officers waited over an hour in the hallway. Meanwhile, the mayor of Uvalde has accused McGraw of continuing to, quote, lie, leak, mislead, or misstate information, unquote, to cover up mistakes made by the state police. On Tuesday, McGraw revealed 91 state troopers responded to the school shooting. Many of the officers were from Operation Lone Star, a joint mission of the Texas Department of Public Safety and the Texas Military Department. McGraw has also revealed both local and state police faced a problem with police radios not working inside the school. On Wednesday, Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez sued Texas Department of Public Safety for withholding documents relating to the shooting. The lawsuit states, quote, in the wake of the senseless tragedy, the people of Uvalde and Texas have demanded answers from their government. To date, they have been met with lies, misstatements, and shifts of blame, he said. An advisor to Ukraine's president has said the fight for Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in eastern Ukraine is, quote, entering a sort of fearsome climax, unquote. If Russia succeeds in fully capturing the two cities, it would give Russia control of the entire Luhansk region. Meanwhile, two drones reportedly struck an oil refinery in southwestern Russia, sparking a large fire. Russia has accused Ukraine of carrying out the attack. In other news from the war, Reporters Without Borders has accused Russian forces of executing Ukrainian photojournalist Max Levin in March. Levin's work had appeared in BBC, Reuters, and other international outlets. President Biden has called on Congress to suspend the federal gas tax for 3 months in a bid to lower gas prices, which have topped $5 a gallon in the months following Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Today, I'm calling for a federal gas tax holiday, state gas tax holiday for the equivalent relief to customers, oil companies to use their profits to increase refining capacity rather than buy back their own stock, gas stations to pass along the decree, the decrease in oil prices to lower prices at the pump. And together, these actions could help drop the price at the pump by up to $1 a gallon or more.
Many economists and progressive lawmakers have criticized Biden's proposal. Congressmember Pramila Jayapal tweeted Wednesday, gas tax holiday won't make it down to consumers or stop the profiteering of oil and gas companies. It also robs the Highway Trust Fund of necessary infrastructure funds. An excess profits tax on oil companies with a rebate to consumers is a better solution, she said. While the price of gas has soared in recent months, oil and gas companies are making record profits, taking in over $41 billion during the first 3 months of this year. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman met with the Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara on Wednesday in a move to fully normalize relations between the two nations. The visit marked Mohammed bin Salman's first trip to Turkey since the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was assassinated inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Khashoggi's fiancée criticized Mohammed bin Salman's visit to Turkey, saying it, quote, doesn't change the fact that he's a murderer, unquote. President Biden's scheduled to travel to Saudi Arabia next month, in part to push Saudi Arabia to pump more oil. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell testified before the Senate Banking Committee Wednesday. Last week, the Fed ordered the largest interest rate increase since 1994. Powell acknowledged the rate hike could lead to a recession, would not lead to lower gas and food prices. He was questioned by Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Chair Powell, will gas prices go down as a result of your interest rate increase?
I would not think so, no.
Okay. That matters because gas prices are one of the single biggest drivers of inflation. Chair Powell, will the Fed's interest rate increases bring food prices down for families?
No, I wouldn't say so, no.
The reason I raise this and the reason I'm so concerned about this is rate increases make it more likely that companies will fire people and slash hours to shrink wage costs. Rate increases also make it more expensive for families to do things like borrow money for a house. And so far, the cost this year of a mortgage has already doubled.
The city of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, has agreed to pay $3.25 million to settle a wrongful death lawsuit brought by Dante Wright's family. Wright, a 20-year-old black man, was fatally shot by a police officer last year after he was pulled over for having an air freshener hanging from his car mirror. The officer, Kim Potter, who is white, was recently sentenced to 2 years in prison. As part of the settlement, the Minneapolis suburb also agreed to change its policies and training related to traffic stops. Here in New York City, three men who were recently held at the city-run Rikers Island jail complex have died in less than a week. The deaths are leading to new calls for control of the jail to be handed over to an outside body. Dr. Robert Cohen, who serves on the Board of Correction, which oversees Rikers, said, quote, the city of New York, despite their best efforts, is not capable of maintaining a minimally safe environment for people in custody, unquote. At least nine people have died so far this year after being held at Rikers. A federal appeals court has upheld a law in Arkansas that requires all state contractors to sign a pledge declaring they will not boycott Israel. Arkansas is one of numerous U.S. states to have passed legislation to criminalize the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, movement. The Council on American Islamic Relations and other groups criticized the ruling. CARE's Lena Mastry said, quote, by declaring Arkansas's anti-BDS law to be constitutional, the court has tacitly endorsed a Palestine exception to the First Amendment. And in Australia, the head of the foundation, which distributes one of the country's most prestigious journalism awards, has denounced the United Kingdom's decision to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. Adele Ferguson, the chair of the Walkley Foundation, has called on Australia to intervene to help Assange, who is an Australian citizen. Ferguson said, quote, Assange has been languishing for years, and it's high time he's brought home. Press freedom and human rights are vital to our society, and what is happening sets a very dangerous precedent at a time when press freedom in this country is being chipped away. This is the time for the government to stand up for press freedom. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Officials in southeastern Afghanistan say a massive earthquake early Wednesday has killed more than 1,000 people. Afghans describe the moment the 5.9 magnitude earthquake struck their homes in Paktika province.
It was midnight when the quake struck. The kids and I screamed. One of our rooms was destroyed. Our neighbors screamed, and we saw everyone's rooms.
It was about midnight when the quake struck. It destroyed the houses of our neighbors. When we arrived, there were many dead and wounded. They sent us to the hospital. I also saw many dead bodies.
The death toll from the earthquake is expected to rise. Thousands have been injured, lost their homes and everything they owned. The earthquake comes as the United Nations reports nearly half of Afghanistan's population already faces acute hunger. The Taliban's called for more international aid while saying sanctions have hampered the government's ability to respond to the multiple crises facing the country. Some aid groups, like the Norwegian Refugee Council, report their teams are now on the ground in Afghanistan to support affected communities with funds and emergency shelter. For more, we're joined by Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Now, he's in Somalia, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But first, Jan, if you can talk about the situation in Afghanistan after this devastating earthquake and what kind of humanitarian work is underway, what needs to get to the affected area?
The situation in eastern Afghanistan, in Khost and in Paktia, is truly desperate. It's like all of the plagues of the Bible falling down on these very poor people at the same time. So we have been operational in Afghanistan for decades. We have 1,408 workers on the ground. We did not leave when the Taliban took over, nor did we leave these areas. So from Khost, the city, we sent teams immediately, and I just got some images of the devastation from our field workers on the ground. These are very poor houses. They have weak structures in very poor mountainous communities. The number of people killed will go up. The 1,000 you just mentioned is too low. Many more will be dead. And we are now rushing with aid. We will build shelter for the people who lost everything. And we'll also try to have cash distributions to those who cannot afford anything at the moment.
And your comment on the Taliban saying that sanctions are hurting aid efforts?
No, of course. I mean, if you're in a country where the aid organization, cannot even do normal bank transfers, the banking system is paralyzed. The regime that took over is under heavy sanctions. It is much more difficult, much more costly to do aid work, but it's not stopping us. We're continuing to work. We understand that people are as angry as we are that the Taliban are preventing girls from getting secondary education, but it would be the ultimate insult to these girls that they starve to death and perish in earthquakes because of our opposition to the education policies of Taliban. So, of course, we have to help. And the sanctions must give a much more clear blanket exemption to humanitarian work. We need to be able to do financial transactions normally, so to our aid workers on the ground.
Well, speaking of hunger, we're going to now look at the global food shortage. As experts warn of a pending global food shortage, not to mention the one that exists now, the United States and European Union have blamed Russia for preventing grain exports from Ukraine, which is one of the world's top wheat suppliers. On Wednesday, Russia pushed back and blamed the food crisis on sanctions imposed on Russia by the United States and European Union over its invasion of Ukraine. This comes as the UK is offering to help escort Ukraine's grain from its ports under a plan designed by the United Nations that's designed to prevent a mass famine across Africa, where the Ukraine war has led to sharp increases in food prices. African countries import nearly half their wheat from Russia and Ukraine. Almost all the wheat in Somalia comes from Ukraine and Russia. And the United Nations says as many as 13 million people there are already facing severe hunger amidst an ongoing drought. On Monday, the UN humanitarian coordinator for Somalia made an urgent call to drastically increase humanitarian aid in the region.
1.5 million children below the age of five are already malnourished, and we expect that 366,000 of them may not survive through the end of September of this year. There are eight districts that are already in what is known an IPC5, that is catastrophic, that is famine situation. That number is bound to increase unless we are able to scale up our response plan in a very, very major way.
For more, we continue with Jan Egeland in Mogadishu, Somalia. Jan Egeland is Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Again, welcome back to Democracy Now! You arrived earlier this week. What have you seen? How devastating is the problem, and how much of it relates to the war in Ukraine?
Well, I'm now in Mogadishu, the capital, but I've been 2 days up in Baidoa, which is one of the hardest hit areas in central Somalia. What I saw there was heart-wrenching, really. Mothers and fathers having walked for 250 kilometers, many of them, to save one child from dying from acute severe malnutrition, bringing them to the therapeutic feeding stations in Badoa town. They told that they had more children at home that had not been able to escape these drought-stricken areas. It's devastating, really. It is a creeping, devastating drought, which is coming after four failed rainy seasons. So it's climate change. It's the climate change that we in the industrialized world caused, and who are dying from this? The children of Somalia, from a people who did nothing to cause climate change. And then again, we are underfunded. We have hundreds of aid workers on the ground, but very little funding for the life-saving efforts.
And Jan, could you speak specifically, first of all, obviously climate change is a massive factor, but do you think that the war in Ukraine has exacerbated the situation because so much of Somalia's wheat came from one of the two countries, both the countries together?
It has. I mean, the food prices has more than doubled in some areas. The 90% of the wheat came from Ukraine, number one, and Russia, number two. That's gone. So the Somali traders now need to compete for grain with Norwegians and Swiss and others who can afford high prices. So it's two things, two external factors, the climate change that leads to the drought and the war in Europe that leads to an exploding prices for food that is really causing this massive famine. And none of these factors were caused by the people. And that's why we're hoping that the G7 nations, including the US now in Germany this weekend, will stand by their pledge to not allow biblical famines in this century. At the moment, the famine is coming.
And And in addition to that, another contributor perhaps is the fact that farmers across Africa have been reporting, in addition to, of course, the increase in prices of wheat, also as high as a 300% increase in the price of imported fertilizer. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and that is curbing food production on the in the continent of Africa that could increase its food production and need to increase its food production. But again, in Somalia, the people I met are living from hand to mouth. They are living from goats and sheep and camels that have died from thirst and from drought. These are pastoralist farmers as well that did not use fertilizer. Here it is the lack of aid and the drought and the food price increase that is the enormous killer.
And finally, Jan, on the question of Ukraine, you were in the eastern part of the country earlier this year. What do you know of what's happened since? You have your organization, the Norwegian Refugee Council, that's working there, and millions of refugees who fled.
Yeah, we, the Norwegian Refugee Council, had our headquarters in the east of Ukraine in Severodonetsk that you have reported upon repeatedly, because that city, that was a vibrant city, it was a city where we had 68 workers, is in ruins now. It's completely destroyed. 90% of all buildings are destroyed, and it's now fighting house by house and cellar, basement by basement in the remaining parts of the city. It's crossfire for the civilians there. We have been able to pre-position food in bomb shelters and so on that people are surviving on at the time being. And remember, the people that have not fled, that are left behind, many of them are elderly and disabled. They are in a desperate situation.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Mogadishu, Somalia. Next up, as experts warn of a looming global food shortage, we look at what led to the crisis and what to do about it. Stay with us.
All the past and present time seems to find a friend in me. Oh, she sings a sweet by and by that's love's about a melody. Like how I'd never seen you left that heart before, till I said I'm your patron saint of the dollar store. Oh, and if I catch hell.
Patron saint of the dollar store, S.G. Goodman. No relation that I know of. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As experts warn of a looming global food shortage on top of what already exists, we're joined by two guests to look at what led to the crisis and what to do about it. In Heidelberg, Germany, Sofia Monsalve-Suarez is Secretary General of FIAN International, a human rights organization working for the right to food and nutrition. In Montpellier, France, Rachel Besner-Kerr is the coordinating lead author for the chapter on climate change impacts and adaptation of food systems for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Their report, titled Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability, that was published in February. Also professor of global development at Cornell University. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sofia Monsalves-Suarez, let's begin with you. Some say the food crisis was triggered by the pandemic and made worse by the war in Ukraine. What do you think of how it started, so we can talk about how it can be dealt with?
Yeah, thank you very much, Amy, for the invitation. First of all, I want to say that this is not a food shortage crisis. Not yet, not now. It may turn to it in a couple of months or next year, but not now. So the problem is access to food, that people don't have money to pay for food, that people are jobless. And as you know, we live in market economies, so we have to have money to have access to food. So this is not new. This is probably the fourth crisis in 15 years. So this very fragile industrial systems, food systems that we have in place are failing. They are extremely fragile to the climate crisis, to the economic shocks, to conflict, and this is the problem. So therefore, this crisis has been long in the make. It is due to the dismantling of public and communal institutions taking care of providing food, skipping support to peasant farming, to decentralized systems. So we put all our eggs into this corporate food system where countries have to rely on long food supply chains, you know, on global trade. And when we see disruptions, COVID was one example, then people in a very vulnerable situation, like, for instance, in Somalia, are in a total mess because they rely on imports. So this is one thing. And then the other thing is the financialization of food systems. There is a lot of speculation already in 2007. There is a speculation on food, on staples. Financial investors are running now on cereals again, on land. And this is a very important factor also in the current crisis.
Sofia, you co-authored an article in The Guardian earlier this month headlined, quote, Ukraine helps feed the world, but its farmers, seeds and future are in danger. In the piece, you point out that in addition to farms and fields in Ukraine being destroyed by Russian forces, Ukraine's national seed bank has been partly destroyed. Could you talk about the importance of seed banks and why they're so important, and the fact, which you also raise, that four companies control 60% of the global seed market?
Yes. Unfortunately, the war in the Ukraine, in this war, Russia has been destroying agricultural structure. As you know, according to international humanitarian law, this is forbidden. It is forbidden to destroy this very important infrastructure. And of course, seed banks are part of this agricultural infrastructure. Now, what we see in the Ukraine is actually that peasant farming, which has been completely neglected for years by the government in Ukraine because it was totally focused on the agribusiness sector for export, is the one which is currently helping to feeding the population in Ukraine because it is resilient even in times of war. So what it is very important is to keep these peasant seed systems in place in the fields. Seed banks are important, but it is even more important to protect peasant seed systems because they are resilient. They are able to adapt to climate change much quicker as we in time as, let's say, varieties developed in labs. So therefore, I think that the important thing that we discover when looking at the example in Ukraine is how resilient peasant farming is, even in times of war and even despite discrimination and total neglect by the government over years.
And I'd like to bring in Rachel Besnaker. You were the lead author on the climate aspects, the food aspects of the latest IPCC report, the climate report. Could you speak about the impact of the climate crisis on food production and access?
Certainly. And just to clarify, I was one of the coordinating lead authors. It was a team of scientists that worked on that chapter. And that's important because there's many different dimensions to the climate crisis. What our assessment showed and emphasized is the way the increasing number of extreme events can lead to acute food insecurity experiences, as we're seeing in places like Somalia and Ethiopia. And they often interact with non-climatic factors to really lead to these acute food crisis situations. So conflict is a very common non-climatic factor that's really leading to these acute food crises. But I also want to agree with Sophia in terms of the points she's raised. We highlighted in the report the vulnerability of smallholder producers to climactic events, in part because they depend on rain-fed agriculture for their livelihoods as well as for food production. And they also play a really important role in providing these diverse food sources to communities and to the globe. And they're often neglected from a policy perspective. And so when you have these extreme events, you often get this lethal combination where you have a drought, so you have reduced food production, or you have flooding, and then you may have infrastructure disruptions. You get a loss of local diverse food types and a spike in food prices, and then poorer households can't afford to get access to that food anymore. And this lethal combination, combined with something like conflict, can really lead to acute food insecurity experiences. And what we documented in the report is increasing scientific evidence of the increased temperature rise from greenhouse gas emissions being directly linked to increased numbers of acute food insecurity events. But I would also agree with Sophia that it's not a crisis that is short-term. This is something that has very much been long-term in the making. And our food system really needs to transform fundamentally to serve the needs of all and to be recognizing the underlying ecosystem that we depend on for our food.
You've said, Rachel.
I could talk about that some more. Go ahead.
Well, Rachel Besnier-Kerr, you've said that poorer nations in Africa and other regions of the world have become increasingly dependent on food imports. Why is that? And particularly looking at the Horn of Africa, at Ethiopia, at Kenya, at Somalia, Oxfam and Save the Children just did a report saying a child is dying every 48 seconds in just those three countries.
Well, the reliance on food imports has been a long-term structural process that was really brought about starting in the 1980s under structural adjustment programs throughout Africa, where countries that were indebted were obliged to carry out programs that reduced their own food production, and they became increasingly reliant on food imports. So it's been a long-term process, and much of what Sophia raised in terms of some of the structural problems with our food system has led to the current circumstance in the Horn of Africa. Of course, in the Horn of Africa, you also have this combination of conflict that and drought in the current moment that has really led to this acute food security crisis.
Rachel, you've also pointed out that the current food production system is heavily reliant on fossil fuels. So could you talk about the impact of that on the climate crisis and how the climate crisis also impacts food production that's reliant on fossil fuels?
Yes. So this is one of the bitter ironies of our current industrial food production system. It's deeply reliant on fossil fuels. So it's a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, which also makes it vulnerable to the other to shocks and really creating vulnerability through the way it produces food. Fertilizer requires a lot of fossil fuel to produce. It also has to have fossil fuels to distribute and to apply. And there are many other components of the way we produce food using this industrial model that leads to considerable greenhouse gas emissions. So in order to have a long-term reduction in the number of crises, we really need to transform our system to not be reliant on fossil fuels. And in our report, we highlight ecosystem-based approaches such as agroecology that rely on ecological processes and reduce this reliance on fossil fuel-based inputs as really the way forward if we're going to have a food system that is stable, resilient, and that is supporting our ecosystem that we depend on. So things like pollinators and water quality, all of those ecosystem services that we depend on are also undermined with the industrial model. And so the key solution for getting out of the crisis that we will be continually experiencing unless we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions is transforming the food system to be much more ecological in the way that we grow and distribute food.
And Sofia Monsalve-Suarez, as we begin to wrap up, if you can comment on what you think are the most critical ways to deal with the hunger crisis in the world today, and who should be making these decisions?
Yes, I think we have to move away finally from this world food security strategy based on global trade. It's based on an industrial food system. It's just simply not working, and it's putting us at an enormous peril of all these famines that we are facing. So therefore, we need to transform the food systems, the industrial food systems, as Rachel is saying, to transition out of fossil fuel-based food systems towards agroecology and food sovereignty. So food sovereignty is about strengthening democracy, strengthening the groups and actors suffering most from hunger and malnutrition. But who is asking them what they need? Who is asking Somalia what they want to have? Nobody. The G7 is making the decisions. G7 want to continue with global trade as it is. No changes at all in the architecture of trade, investment, and finances. And this is the problem. So we really urgently need to tackle this and to speak and listen to the populations and the countries which are suffering most now.
Well, Sofia Monsalve-Suarez, we thank you so much for being with us, Secretary General of FIAN International, and Rachel Besner-Kerr, Professor of Global Development at Cornell University, one of the coordinating authors of a chapter in the major IPCC climate change report. Next up, the World Trade Organization makes a major decision about COVID vaccines. Stay with us.
À ceux qui n'en ont pas, à ceux qui n'en ont pas, Rosa, Rosa, quand on fout le bordel, tu nettoies. Et toi, Albert, quand on trinque, tu ramasses les verres. Céline, Bater, toi tu te prends des vestes au vestiaire. Arlette, arrête. Toi la fête, tu la passes aux toilettes. Et si on célébrait ceux qui ne célèbrent pas? Pour une fois, j'aimerais lever mon verre à ceux qui n'en ont pas. À ceux qui n'en ont pas. Quoi les bonnes manières? Pourquoi je ferais semblant? De toute façon, on est payé pour le faire. Tu te prends pour ma mère? Dans une heure je reviens, que ce soit propre, qu'on puisse y manger par terre. Trois heures que j'attends. Franchement, il est fabrique ou quoi? Heureusement que c'est que de verre. Appelle-moi ton responsable et fais vite, elle pourrait se finir comme ça, ta carrière. Oui, célébrons ceux qui ne célèbrent pas.
Sante by Stromae. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Hundreds of public health and civil society organizations have denounced the World Trade Organization for approving a text last week that they say leaves in place intellectual property barriers that will continue to limit global access to COVID-19 vaccines, tests, and treatments. In Cape Town, South Africa, Fatima Hassan is the founder and director of Health Justice Initiative in South Africa, whose recent op-ed is headlined, New WTO Deal is a Slap in the Face to Poorer Countries. And in New York City, we're joined by Mihir Mankad. He is a senior advisor for global health advocacy and policy for Doctors Without Borders, known as MSF. He was at the World Trade Organization meeting. Welcome to both of you to Democracy Now! Mihir Mankad, if you could lay out what happened at the meeting. I think part of why decisions like these can happen is because it is so hard to understand for the rest of the world the kind of bureaucratic language that's used.
Sure. Thank you, Amy. In fact, it seems like nothing much happened, unfortunately, and as you just stated, we were really disappointed in the outcome that was reached. You know, the negotiations for this particular decision have been taking place since May, but for the last 18 months, the World Trade Organization has been discussing a proposal by India and South Africa to completely suspend intellectual property rights on the full range of COVID-19 medical tools. And that's, in fact, you know, not what was discussed at all in Geneva last week. And in fact, a block of rich countries, the EU, the United States, UK, and Switzerland, amongst others, kind of led the charge, in essence, to arrive at this watered-down decision, which, in fact, doesn't waive any intellectual property rights and in our opinion, you know, may ultimately cause more damage than good.
Fatima Hassan, you wrote a piece following the WTO decision, headlined, The New WTO Deal is a Slap in the Face for Poorer Countries. Could you explain why you think that's the case and what role you believe the Director General of the WTO made in enabling this decision? She is, of course, the first African and the first woman to head the organization.
Thank you. So we've argued that it's a weak deal because it's not a waiver. It's not the waiver that was proposed by South Africa and India. It only deals with vaccines and it only deals with patents. And in fact, the entire deal is more about a summary of what you would have to do if you decide to manufacture vaccines and export them. So it deals quite significantly with export rights and who should be opting in and who should be opting out of the deal. Doesn't deal with all the other elements of intellectual property like copyright and trade secrets or the recipes and the knowledge that we actually need to scale up manufacturing. And it doesn't even deal with treatment and diagnostics in the middle of 2022. And so when we've said that this is a weak deal that has been enabled by the Secretariat and the leadership of the DG, what we mean by that is that we believe that countries were bullied into silence, that countries were bullied into submission in the last 2.5 months, and that the text that was actually put forward by the DG of the WTO was based on what the EU and the US wanted. And so the process that was followed to ram through that text through what we call green room secret negotiations, excluding certain countries, you know, basically ensuring that the African group was silenced and unable to propose any textual amendments, doesn't actually befit an institution that is supposed to be based on consensus and an institution that is supposed to prioritize everybody's lives and everybody's rights in the middle of a pandemic. So we have argued that the WTO, for us, is not really not fit for purpose. And the TRIPS agreement that deals with aspects of life-saving medical technologies is also clearly, from what we've seen in the last 2 years, not fit for purpose either.
So, Meher, could you get into some of the details of what precisely this agreement entailed, the issue also, if you could explain, of compulsory licensing? And finally, the fact that the U.S. Last year in May, the Biden administration expressed its support for temporarily waiving intellectual property rights for COVID vaccines. What was the position that U.S. Delegates took at this meeting?
Sure. So I think Fatima put it perfectly well. This current agreement doesn't waive any intellectual property rights, and in fact is simply a clarification of some existing procedure with a small waiver, as it were, concerning the exportation of goods produced through the use of a compulsory license. Under normal circumstances, and that's only for COVID-19 tools, I should say, and for a limited period, just 5 years. So under normal circumstances, a compulsory license is something that allows someone else to produce or make use of a good or a patent that the patent holder holds. And in general, the TRIPS agreement allows for the use of compulsory licenses. However, the products produced through those compulsory licenses are meant to be primarily for domestic purposes. And this decision expands that slightly to allow for those products to be exported as well to a certain eligible countries. Those eligible countries are primarily or only developing countries in this case. And even then, the agreement encourages those countries that have vaccine production amongst developing countries to opt out. So, for example, China has opted out, and China happens to be one of the world's largest vaccine producers. So in some sense, of course, this is completely counterproductive. Along with that, as Fatima mentioned, this decision doesn't include immediately treatments or diagnostics in its scope. And that's hugely problematic considering where we are in this pandemic. And insofar as the U.S.'s role and position, you're right that the Biden administration agreed to a waiver last year, or at least stated a commitment to pursuing that. And what we found, you know, in Geneva last week and over the course of the last few months is that the administration has been very hesitant to state a public position. It's in fact, I think, as we learned over the course of the last week or so, been effectively pushing back on the immediate inclusion of treatments and diagnostics in this decision, and also in pushing back on ensuring that the full scope of intellectual property is covered by this particular agreement. So, you know, know-how, industrial design, copyright, and other things that might be critical to, as Fatima said, again, ensuring that there's adequate global scale-up of all the necessary COVID-19 medical tools.
The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, Pharma President and CEO Stephen Ubel, condemned the final deal reached by the WTO, saying pharmaceutical companies had produced more than 13 billion vaccines and had the capacity to vaccinate everyone in the world. And the problems countries have encountered in vaccinating their populations have more to do with distribution issues rather than access. He said, rather than focus on real issues affecting public health, like solving supply chain bottlenecks or reducing border tariffs on medicines, they approved an intellectual property waiver on COVID-19 vaccines that won't help protect people against the virus. He said, despite the fact that vaccines have been made available, quote, last mile distribution challenges are causing countries around the world to destroy unused vaccines and turn away donations. Rather than resolving these issues, diplomats spent the past year and a half arguing at the World Trade Organization over ways to undermine the very intellectual property rights that enabled hundreds of collaborations to produce the COVID-19 vaccines on a global scale. I want to put this question to Fatima Hassan. You're in South Africa. If you can put in very lay terms what we're really talking about here and what pharma, you know, the major corporations that have made more money than they've ever made in their history off these vaccines, what he is saying.
Thanks. So I think that the industry can spin it however they wish to. But what we have is a track record in the past 2 years that timely access to the right vaccines at the right time, particularly for the African continent, was not possible because the single largest barrier facing us at that time when we needed those vaccines was intellectual property barriers. And so the irony is that the industry is using a set of circumstances and facts that is currently applicable to justify the practices of both the industry as well as the EU and the US for the past 20 months. And 100 countries, 65 co-sponsors, very clearly articulated that the issue was not so much what the industry is now talking about as far back as October 2020, and that the invocation of patents, of copyrights, of trade secret was a barrier to scaling up manufacturing on an expeditious basis. So this argument, what we call the glut argument, that the industry has been, in my view, peddling for the last few months, is a very convenient distraction from the real barrier that IP faces, not just for vaccine production or the new generation vaccines that we're going to need in the next few months, but also for treatment and diagnostics. Currently, we're facing a situation of treatment apartheid, where IP is the barrier to enabling countries to be able to use a generic version of a treatment that is very widely available currently in the US. So I think that for us, it boils down to the fact that exactly what the US and EU wanted all along, which was to limit it to only vaccines and patents or to only talk about compulsory licensing, is exactly what the WTO has delivered to them in the form of this deal. So basically, they won. They got exactly what they wanted. And, you know, I think really enabled by an industry that has been claiming this all along, that the waiver won't make a difference, that it would harm innovation, that it would harm their IP. And Amy, you and I have previously spoken about whose IP was it.
And just to be clear, IP means intellectual property.
Yes.
Keep going.
No, and you know, just to sum up there is that the IP, the intellectual property, the patents, the knowledge that was generated off the back of public funding and public scientists, I think really with this deal, one has to, you know, take a long, hard look at how multilateralism at the WTO is actually failing us. It's a very warped multilateralism, but also that TRIPS is no longer fit for purpose. The TRIPS agreement on intellectual property for medicines and medical technologies is not for purpose, because this is the way in which we are interpreting it, and this is the way in which we are dealing with it in the middle of a pandemic. It doesn't bode well for what's to come next.
Mihir, could you also respond to what the pharmaceutical industry said, namely that the main problem is one of distribution and enabling vaccinations to be administered in the developing world, that there are doses, but there are problems with distribution and actual vaccination, number one. And then is the main issue now, as Fatima has also said, the main issue at the moment is enabling access to treatments and diagnostics for the developing world?
Yeah, so I would agree that, you know, the industry is crying crocodile tears here by raising a fear, you know, concerning this particular decision, which I'm sure they're aware won't do nearly what they claim it will do. Insofar as the supply and distribution concerns are concerned, I think Fatima's right that, you know, it's a question of timing and adequacy, you know, and the capability of rapid deployment, you know, some of which perhaps have to do with distributional concerns, but, you know, are still at the core a question of, you know, whether we have enough and then whether that can be, you know, moved around adequately, much of which is protected or prevented, rather, I should say, by intellectual property barriers. So, you know, what we've seen, you know, over the course of the last 18 months is that, you know, these barriers have inhibited companies in the global south who are perfectly willing and capable of producing these vaccinations to actually do so. And you know, especially early on, you know, in the first year or so of vaccination, we saw massive shortfalls that have now led to huge amounts of global inequity. So, you know, in general, I think, you know, this is, of course, still an ongoing question. And the fact that it's very likely that we'll be needing boosters on an ongoing basis, you know, makes it even more urgent. And at the moment, it's correct, I think, that to say that treatments are, you know, one of the most pressing issues with respect to access. And that's because, you know, most of the effective treatments are under intellectual property control by just a few corporations. And there is, you know, for the time being, at least this year, no major supply available through anyone besides those originator companies. And even that which is available through those companies is in very limited stock and purchased mostly by high-income countries. So, you know, unfortunately, we're just making the same mistakes over and over again. The same mistakes we made with vaccines and access to vaccines early on in the pandemic is the same mistake we're making with treatments right now.
Let me ask Fatima Hassan in South Africa, is the pandemic ending?
Not from where we're sitting, no.
And Mihir Mankad, with Doctors Without Borders, you have this global perspective. What do you see right now?
No, I don't think we're in a position to claim that the pandemic's ending, and you know, neither that WHO has also not indicated that the pandemic is ending anytime soon.
And finally, Fatima, what do you think would be the single most important action could be taken right now to deal with this ongoing pandemic?
So, unfortunately, because we have this weak deal, I think the single pressing thing that needs to happen is that every single country in the global south has to start issuing compulsory licenses, but not just on vaccines, also on treatments and on diagnostics, because they are ordinarily permitted to do that under the TRIPS agreement. So if we don't have strong domestic action or strong domesticating
we have of the 10 very seconds.
Weak deal, we won't be able to get out of this pandemic.
Fatima Hassan, we want to thank you for being with us. Health Justice Initiative, speaking to us from South Africa. And Mihir Mankad with Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, speaking to us from New York City. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Masaya Rhodes, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.